All this had taken place in only 10 to 15 minutes. Lieutenant Neil Kroger's platoon had taken the brunt of the enemy attack. Although artillery and airstrikes were taking a toll on the follow-up forces, a large group of North Vietnamese soldiers had reached Kroger's lines, and the killing was hand-to-hand. Specialist Arthur Vieira was crouched in a small foxhole firing his M79. The gunfire was very loud. We were getting overrun on the right side. The lieutenant, Kroger, came up out into the open in all this. I thought that was pretty good. He yelled at me. I got up to hear him. He hollered at me to help cover the left sector. I ran over to him, and by the time I got there, he was dead. He had lasted a half hour. I knelt beside him, took off his dog tags, and put them in my shirt pocket. I went back to firing my M79 and got shot in my right elbow. The M79 went flying, and I was knocked over and fell back over the lieutenant. Vieira now grabbed his .45 pistol and began firing it left-handed. Then I got hit in the neck, and the bullet went right through. I couldn't talk or make a sound. I got up and tried to take charge and was shot with a third round. That one blew up my right leg and put me down. It went in my leg above the ankle, traveled up, came back out, then went into my groin and ended up in my back close to my spine. Just then, two stick grenades blew up right over me and tore up both of my legs. I reached down with my left hand and touched grenade fragments on my left leg, and it felt like I had touched a red-hot poker. My hand just sizzled. Sergeant Jemison was over in Lieutenant Gahagan's 2nd Platoon lines. My machine guns just kept cutting them down. The enemy drifted to our right front. At least a battalion was out there. Some 35 yards to Jemison's right rear, Lieutenant John Arrington had safely negotiated the open clearing and made it to the Charlie Company foxhole to take over from the badly wounded Captain Edwards. Arrington made it to my command post and, after a few moments of talking to me while lying down at the edge of the foxhole, was wounded. He was worried that he had been hit pretty bad and told me to be sure and tell his wife that he loved her. I thought, doesn't he know that I am wounded too? Arrington was hit in the arm and the bullet passed into his chest and grazed a lung. He was in pain, suffering silently. He also caught some shrapnel from an M79 that the enemy had apparently captured and were firing to the trees above us. The enemy were now closing in on Lieutenant Gahagan's platoon. They were already intermingled with Kroger's surviving men and were pushing on toward Edwards' foxhole. At 7:45 a.m., the enemy struck at the left flank of Tony Nadal's Alpha Company, at that critical elbow where Alpha and Charlie companies were tied in. We were now under attack from three directions. Grazing fire from rifles and heavy machine guns shredded the elephant grass and swept over the battalion command post and aid station. Leaves, bark, and small branches fluttered down on us. Several troopers were wounded in the command post, and at least one was killed. My radio operator, Specialist 4 Robert P. Ouellette, 23 years old, a bespectacled six-footer from Madawaska, Maine, was hit and slumped over in a sprawl, unmoving and seemingly dead. I kept the handset to my ear. The situation was now so critical that there was no time to deal with Ouellette. At about this time, 15 or more mortar and rocket rounds exploded all around the Termite Hill command post. We were locked into a fight to the death, taking heavy casualties in the Charlie Company area, and there was no question that we were going to need help. I radioed Colonel Tim Brown to ask him to prepare another company of reinforcements for movement as soon as it could be accomplished without undue risk. Brown, with typical foresight, had already alerted Alpha Company's 2nd Battalion and had it assembled with the helicopters to fly in on call. Joe Galloway remembers, "The incoming fire was only a couple of feet off the ground, and I was down as flat as I could get when I felt the toe of a combat boot in my ribs. I turned my head sideways and looked up. There, standing tall, was Sergeant Major Basil Plumley. Plumley leaned down and shouted over the noise of the guns, 'You can't take no pictures laying down there on the ground, sonny.' He was calm, fearless, and grinning. I thought, 'He's right. We're all going to die anyway, so I might as well take mine standing up. I got up and began to take a few photographs. Plumley moved over to the aid station, pulled out his .45 pistol, chambered around, and informed Dr. Carrara and his medics, "Gentlemen, prepare to defend yourselves." The enemy commander's assault into the Delta Company line was not going well. In fact, he would have done a good deal better attacking any other sector of the perimeter. Delta Company now had its own 6 M60 machine guns, plus 3 more M60s from the recon platoon, stretched across a 75-yard front. Each gun had a full 4-man crew and triple the usual load of boxed ammunition, 6,000 rounds of 7.62mm. To the left rear of the machine guns were the battalion's 81mm mortars, whose crews were firing in support of Charlie Company and, meanwhile, fending off the enemy at closer range with their rifles and M79s. Specialist Willard F. Parrish, 24 years old and a native of Bristow, Oklahoma, was assistant squad leader of one of Charlie Company's 81mm mortar squads. Parrish was one of the mortar men who had been outfitted with the spare machine guns and rifles collected from our casualties and put on the Delta Company perimeter. Parrish recalls, "When we were hit, I remember all the tracer rounds, and I wondered how even an ant could get through that. Back to our right, we started hearing the guys hollering, 'They're coming around, they're coming around.' I was in a foxhole with a guy from Chicago, PFC James E. Coleman, and he had an M16. I had my .45 and his .45, and I had an M60 machine gun. We were set up facing out into the tall grass. I was looking out front, and I could see some of the grass going down like somebody was crawling in it. I hollered, 'Who's out there?' Nobody answered, so I hollered again. No answer. I turned to Coleman. 'Burn his ass.' Coleman said, 'My rifle's jammed.' I looked at him and him at me. Then I looked back at the front, and they were growing out of the weeds. I just remember getting out that machine gun, and from there on, I guess the training takes over and you put your mind somewhere else, because I really don't remember what specifically I did. I was totally unaware of the time, the conditions." On that M60 machine gun, according to extracts from a Silver Star citation, Specialist Parrish delivered lethal fire on wave after wave of the enemy until he ran out of ammunition. Then, standing up under fire with a .45 pistol in each hand, Parrish fired clip after clip into the enemy, who were 20 yards out. He stopped their attack. Says Parrish, "I feel like I didn't do any more than anybody else did up there. I remember a lot of noise, a lot of yelling, and then all at once it was quiet." The silence out in front of Willard Parrish was that of the cemetery. More than 100 dead North Vietnamese were later found where they had fallen in a semicircle around his foxhole. Specialist 4 Vincent Cantu had been drafted into the Army the day before President John Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. He had 1 week left in service, and he had been praying that he would live to make it home to Refugio, Texas, where he had been the lead guitarist and singer for a local band called the Rockin' Dominoes. Says Cantu, "The fighting never let up for long. The artillery fired all around us continually. The jets bombarded the hell out of that mountain. I got word that a friend of mine from Houston, Hilario de la Paz, had gotten killed. He had only 4 days left in the Army. He had 2 young daughters back in Houston." Hilario de la Paz, Jr. was killed that morning in the attack on Delta Company. He was just 18 days past his 26th birthday. During that fierce attack on the Delta and Charlie Company lines, Cantu recalls, "I was hugging the ground better than a snake when I saw what appeared to be a soldier in camouflage with 2 or 3 cameras dangling around his neck. He came from behind a tree and took 2 or 3 snapshots, then ducked back behind a big old anthill. I thought to myself, 'Man, he wants pictures for a scrapbook real bad.' I lay there for a moment, and I started to think, 'This guy reminds me of someone.' I crawled to the tree because next time this guy appears, I wanted a better look. But I also wanted protection. I didn't have to wait long. There was no mistake. It was hot. His face was red. It was my old friend, Joe Galloway. I felt joy at seeing someone from Refugio, but at the same time sadness because I didn't want anyone from home being killed, and he was going about it the right way. Galloway and Cantu were classmates. In 1959, they graduated from Refugio High School together with 55 others. Cantu braved the hail of fire, sprinted across the corner of the open landing zone, and dived under a bush where Galloway was kneeling.
Joe Galloway! Don't you know me, man? It's Vince Cantu from Refugio!
The two men embraced, agreed that this was some kind of bad shit, and for a few brief minutes, stolen from the battle raging around them, talked of home, family, and friends. Cantu told the reporter, "If I live, I will be home for Christmas." Vince Cantu survived and made it back to Refugio, Texas, population 4,944, just in time for the holidays. Chapter 13. Friendly Fire. Dulce bellum inexpertis. War is delightful to those who have no experience of it. Erasmus. The ordeal of rifleman Arthur Vieira, crumpled on the ground, terribly wounded, beside the body of Lieutenant Neil Kroger, was just beginning.
The enemy was all over at least a couple of hundred of them, walking around for 3 or 4 minutes. It seemed like 3 or 4 hours, shooting and machine-gunning our wounded and laughing and giggling, Vieira recalls. I knew they'd kill me if they saw I was alive. When they got near, I played dead. I kept my eyes open and stared at a small tree. I knew the dead men had their eyes open. Then one of the North Vietnamese came up, looked at me, then kicked me, and I flopped over. I guess he thought I was dead. There was blood running out of my mouth, my arm, my legs. He took my watch and my .45 pistol and walked on. I saw them strip off all our weapons. Then they left, back where they came from. I remember the artillery, the bombs, and the napalm everywhere, real close around me. It shook the ground underneath me. But it was coming in on the North Vietnamese soldiers, too.
Over in the 2nd Platoon sector, Sergeant Jemison was struck in the stomach by a single bullet. He ignored the pain, continued firing, and exhorted those still alive to fire faster and hang on. Clinton Poley, the Iowa farm boy, was still alive in the firestorm. When I got up, something hit me real hard on the back of my neck, knocked my head forward, and my helmet fell off in the foxhole. I thought a guy had snuck up behind me and hit me with the butt of a weapon. It was such a blow. Wasn't anybody there. It was a bullet from the side or rear. I put my bandage on it, and the helmet helped hold it on. I got up to look again, and there were 4 of them with carbines off to our right front. I told Comer to aim more to the right. A little after that, I heard a scream, and I thought it was Lieutenant Gehagen. Polian Specialist Comer, the man on the trigger of the M60, blazed away at large numbers of plainly visible enemy troops. There was no wind, and the smoke and dust hanging over the battlefield were getting worse by the minute, making it ever more difficult for the Air Force, Navy, and Marine fighter bomber pilots and Army Huey gunship pilots overhead to pick out our lines. On my order, at 7:55 a.m., all platoons threw colored smoke grenades to define our perimeter for the pilots. Then we brought all fire support in extremely close. Moments after throwing his colored smoke, Sergeant Robert Jemison was struck a second time by a round that tore into his left shoulder. It had been about 20 minutes since he was first hit in the stomach. He got back up again and resumed firing his rifle. 30 minutes later, Jemison was shot a third time. It was an automatic weapon. It hit me in my right arm and tore my weapon all to pieces. All that was left was the plastic stock. Another bullet cut off the metal clamp on my chin strap and knocked off my helmet. It hit so hard I thought my neck was broken. I was thrown to the ground. I got up and there was nothing left. No weapon, no grenades, no nothing.
Comer and Poley, 30 feet to Jemison's left, were likewise coming on hard times. Poley says,
A stick-handled potato masher grenade landed in front of the hole. Comer hollered, "Get down," and kicked it away a little bit with his foot. It went off. By then, we were close to out of ammo, and the gun had jammed. In that cloud of smoke and dust, we started to our left, trying to find other second platoon positions. That's when I got hit in the chest, and I hit the ground pretty hard. I got up and got shot in my hip and went down again. Comer and I lost contact with each other in the long grass. We had already lost our ammo bearer, PFC Charlie H. Collier from Mount Pleasant, Texas, who had been killed the day before. He was only 18 and had been in Vietnam just a few days. I managed to run about 20 yards at a time for three times and finally came to part of the mortar platoon. A sergeant had two guys help me across a clearing to the battalion command post by the large anthill. The battalion surgeon, the captain, gave me first aid. Captain Bob Edwards was still holding on in his foxhole. I think that the fire support prevented the enemy from reinforcing when he really could have hurt us. The penetration reached the first line of holes of the two platoons that had the most contact. Captain John Heron of Bravo Company says, "The enemy broke through to Edwards' command post before he was stopped, mainly by the battalion use of artillery, air, and helicopter rockets and gunships. It was, in my view, the closest we came to being overrun." Bob Edwards' personal war was far from over. Some 30 yards from his foxhole was a large termite hill covered with brush and grass. Atop that mound was North Vietnamese with an automatic weapon who was a damned good shot. He had killed Sergeant Hostutler. He had wounded Bob Edwards and Lieutenant Arrington, and he was still firing. We were pretty much pinned down by an automatic weapon sighted behind an anthill in front of the 3rd Platoon's left side. Lieutenant Bill Franklin tried to reach us, but he, too, was hit. I'm not sure if this was before or after Arrington was wounded. We had at least 4 of us hit by that one person within an hour. Then Sergeant Kennedy came up after Arrington was wounded and single-handedly eliminated the threat with grenades in his rifle. This took the bind off of us. Comer and Poley's machine gun was not the only one which had fallen silent. George Fox, 25, and Nathaniel Byrd, 22, were slumped across their silent M60 machine gun, surrounded by heaps of empty shell casings and empty ammunition cans. They had died together, shoulder to shoulder. Sergeant Jemison pays them the ultimate compliment of a professional soldier. "Bird and Fox did a great job. They kept firing that gun and didn't leave it. They stayed on it to the end." It was time to clean out the enemy overwhelming the left side of Charlie Company. Dylan and I talked it over and agreed we now had to commit our reserve. I told Lieutenant James T. Rackstraw to take his recon platoon and counterattack on the left side of the Charlie Company sector. I pointed at the precise area of the perimeter he was to attack and told him to coordinate his movements with Lieutenant Litton of Delta Company. After his platoon secured the left side of Charlie, I told him he was to join Litton and kill the enemy behind the mortars. Then, to reconstitute a reserve, I ordered Captain Myron Diderick to bring his Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion Command Group, and one of his platoons off the line and into a dispersed position near the battalion command post. He was to stand by to block, reinforce, or counterattack into Bob Edwards' sector of the line or anywhere else that came under heavy attack. Diderick took off at a dead run and was back with Lieutenant Rescorla's platoon by 8:15 a.m., A heavy volume of grazing fire was covering the entire LZ. Rescorla's platoon had 1 killed, 1 wounded. By now, most of the men in Bob Edwards' 2 hardest-hit platoons were either dead or wounded. The job of holding off the enemy fell to the few still up and shooting. Somehow, PFC Larry D. Stevenson of Delta Company found himself in Lieutenant Gahagan's platoon sector, the only soldier left holding a 50-yard section of the line. He calmly dropped to 1 knee and methodically shot 15 enemy before help finally arrived. That help was the battalion recon platoon. They cleaned out the Charlie Company left, then shifted toward the center of Charlie Company's lines and linked up with them for the rest of the fight. That portion of the perimeter was now under control. The maneuver took some of the pressure off the landing zone,
and we noticed an immediate slackening in the volume of fire sweeping the clearing. I radioed word to brigade headquarters to send the lift helicopters in with Alpha Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cavalry. Somewhere in this time frame, I noticed that my radio operator, Bob Ouellette, was sitting back up, looking shaky but functioning again. I took a closer look and discovered he had been knocked cold by a bullet which had penetrated his helmet, but not his head. I told him, "Ouellette, never give up that helmet. It saved your life." The crusty old medical platoon sergeant, Thomas Keaton, says, "I remember Colonel Moore's radio operator. He just suddenly dropped. I thought he had laid down and gone to sleep. I was kind of mad at him. Went over and kicked the hell out of him. Told him to get off his ass and help us with the wounded. No response. I picked up his helmet and a bullet fell out. A round had gone through the steel pot and helmet liner. Knocked him cold as a cube. He had a big lump in his head." All of us in the vicinity of the battalion command post were now shocked by an event that unfolded slow motion in front of our disbelieving eyes. I was on one knee facing south toward the mountain. Ouellette, still dazed, was kneeling beside me. Movement off to the west, my right, caught my eye. I jerked my head around and looked straight into the noses of two F-100 Super Sabre jet fighters aiming directly at us. At that moment, the lead aircraft released two shiny 6-foot-long napalm canisters, which slowly began lob-lollying end over end toward us. The fearsome sight of those cans of napalm is indelibly imprinted in my memory. It was only 3 or 4 seconds from release to impact and explosion, but it seemed like a lifetime. They were released by the lead F-100 and were on a direct line for the right side of the command post, where Sergeant George Nye and his demolition team were dug in the tall grass. The jets were on a very low pass. I couldn't do anything about those first two napalm cams, but I had to do something to stop the pilot of the second plane, who was aimed directly at the left side of the command post, from releasing his two canisters. If he hit the pickle switch, bomb release button, he would definitely take out Hal Moore, Captain Carrara, Sergeant Keaton, Captain Dillon, Sergeant Major Plumley, Joe Galloway, Captain Whiteside, Lieutenant Hastings, our radio operators, radios, medical supplies, and ammunition, and the wounded huddled in the aid station. The nerve center, the life center of this battalion, would be instantly killed in the middle of a cliffhanger battle for survival. I yelled at the top of my lungs to Charlie Hastings, the Air Force FAC, "Call that son of a bitch off! Call him off!" Joe Galloway heard Hastings screaming into his radio, "Pull up! Pull up!" Matt Dillon says, "I can still see the canisters tumbling toward us. I remember thinking, turn your eyes away so you won't be blinded." "I put my face into a reporter's shoulder to hide my eyes," was Joe Galloway's. I could hear good time Charlie Hastings shouting into his radio, "Pull up." The second jet did. The napalm from the first hit some people and some ammo caught on fire. Sergeant Major Plumley jumped up to put out the fire around the ammo. I ran out into the LZ to put an air panel out. Sergeant Nye says, "Two of my people, PFC Jimmy D. Nakayama and Specialist 5 James Clark, were on the other side of me, several yards away. Somebody was hollering and Colonel Moore was standing there hollering something about a wingman, and I looked up. There were two planes coming and one of them had already dropped his napalm and everything seemed to go into slow motion. Everything was on fire. Nakayama was all black and Clark was all burned and bleeding." Galloway: "Before I had walked over and talked to the engineer guys in their little foxholes, now those same men were dancing in the fire. The hair burned off in an instant. Their clothes were incinerated. One was a mass of blisters. The other not quite so bad, but he had breathed the fire into his lungs. When the flames died down, we all ran out into the burning grass. Somebody yelled at me to grab the feet of one of the charred soldiers. When I got them, the boots crumbled and the flesh came off, and I could feel the bare bones of his ankles in the palms of my hands. We carried him into the aid station. I can still hear their screams." Specialist for Thomas E. Burlisle, a medical aid man from Myron Diederich's Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, rushed out into the clearing with his kit bag to help the napalm victims. Burlisle was shot in the head and died within minutes in Lieutenant Rescorla's arms. An Oklahoman, Burlisle had turned 23 years old just 4 days before he was killed. Sergeant Keaton in the battalion aid station quickly shot Nakayama and Clark up with morphine, but it gave little relief. They were horribly burned. Their screams pierced the hearts of every man within hearing. Both soldiers were evacuated, but PFC Nakayama, a native of Rigby, Idaho, died 2 days later, on November 17th, just 2 days short of his 23rd birthday. Says Sergeant Nye, Nakayama was a real friend of mine. A good kid. Used to call me China Joe. He caught me one time with a Chinese girl, and that nickname stuck with me through the whole war. I called him Mizo. In Japanese, that meant rain god. The day he died, his wife had their baby. A week after he died, his reserve commission as a lieutenant came through. Every damn guy in Landing Zone X-Ray was a hero, but the real heroes were guys like Nakayama. I lost good people in there. They gave their all. Every time I hear a helicopter, I get all watery-eyed. It's hard to explain. Back in the command post, our Air Force FAC Charlie Hastings was stunned by the tragic consequences of the misplaced airstrike. Hastings recalls, "After the napalm strike, Colonel Moore looked at me and says something that I never forgot. 'Don't worry about that one, Charlie. Just keep them coming.'" Shortly after the napalm strike, an enemy soldier staggered and stumbled into the clearing from behind Bob Edwards' far left flank. He had no weapon, was severely wounded, and judging by his black uniform, was evidently a member of the H-15 VC battalion. Staff Sergeant Otis J. Hull, a 30-year-old native of Tarraha, West Virginia, and one of his recon platoon men, ran to the enemy soldier and brought him into the command post aid station for medical treatment. He died before we could evacuate him and was buried in a shallow grave nearby. The battle in the Charlie Company sector raged on. Most of Kroger's men were down. A handful, like Arthur Vieira, had escaped the enemy execution squads and were hunkered down in positions where the heavy close-in fire support shielded them. Over on the far right, Lieutenant Lane's platoon was having a hard time of it, perhaps because they were just to the left of the creek bed highway that led into our positions. Sergeant John Settlin, "The airstrikes and the artillery were hitting almost in our holes for 45 minutes, maybe an hour. That's when I was hit by white phosphorus. The attacks came at various parts of our line. They were determined to overrun us. I guess we were determined enough that we were not going to go down. And we didn't." At about 9 a.m., Lieutenant Dick Tift, who was controlling the helicopter lifts, gave me the welcome news that Alpha Company 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry was a few minutes out on final approach. At 9:10 a.m., Captain Joel E. Sugdinis, 28, West Point class of 1960, landed with his 3rd platoon led by Lieutenant William Sisson. That platoon immediately headed south toward the sound of the guns in the Charlie Company sector, deploying in the scrub brush behind the few survivors of Lieutenant Gahagan's platoon. I briefed Sugdinis and pointed him to Myron Diederich's sector, telling Myron to see that Sugdinis was thoroughly oriented. S. Lawrence Larry Gwynn, Jr., 24 and a native Bostonian, was Sugdinis's executive officer. Commissioned out of Yale University ROTC, Gwynn had spent 2 years in the 82nd Airborne, was Ranger qualified, and had studied the Vietnamese language at the Defense Language School in Monterey, California for 2 months. "That LZ was hot. When I got off my ship, there were rounds coming in. Out in the LZ, PFC Donald Allred popped up out of the grass and said, 'Lieutenant, I've been hit.' We patched him up, and now we knew we were in Zulu land. Alpha Company closed up, with the exception of Sisson's platoon, which was almost immediately detached. That is significant because we would not see them again until 4 days later." Sergeant John Marinich, a 35-year-old career soldier from Scranton, Pennsylvania, was a squad leader in Sugdinis's mortar platoon.
We had no sooner landed than firing grew intense. At that time, we of the mortar platoon thought of as riflemen. Five of us were told to move to a section of the line which was lightly held. We spotted about 20 enemy and killed them all. One North Vietnamese I killed was running at me, screaming and firing a rifle. After I killed him, I saw he was an officer. I took his pistol out of the holster and put it in my pack. After 2.5 hours, the battle for Charlie Company finally wound down. Sergeant Sedlin recalls, "The firing stopped as quickly as it started. The enemy dead were stacked 2 or 3 deep in front of us. In the logs we would kick and shovel dirt up on them to keep the stink and flies down." Lieutenant Lane now made his way over to Bob Edwards' foxhole without incident. All the officers in Charlie Company were either dead or wounded. Captain Bob Edwards had done all that duty demanded and much, much more. He had also lost a lot of blood. Turning over command to Lieutenant Lane, Edwards was pushed and pulled out of his foxhole by Lane, Sergeant Glenn Kennedy, and Sergeant James Castleberry. At the Termite Hill command post, I called Myron Dieterich over and ordered him to move with his one assembled platoon to Bob Edwards' sector, assume control of the survivors of Charlie Company and Lane's platoon, and clean out and defend that portion of the perimeter. At 9:41 a.m., he and his troopers moved out, followed in minutes by his other platoon after Joel Sugdinis took over that sector. I attached Sugdinis' 3rd platoon under Lieutenant Sisson to Myron Dieterich's Bravo Company's 2nd battalion. By 10 a.m., the surviving North Vietnamese were withdrawing. Charlie Company had held its ground in a stunning display of personal courage and unit discipline. The brave men of Gahagan's and Kroger's platoons had stood and died fighting for each other and holding their ground. The senior-ranking survivor in those 2 platoons was Platoon Sergeant Jemison. Asked why the enemy failed to overrun his platoon, Jemison says, "First, it was Bird and Fox on the machine gun on the right. At the end, what saved us was Comer's machine gun." Charlie Company 1st Battalion 7th Cavalry had begun this day with 5 officers and 106 men. By noon, it had no officers left and only 49 men unhurt. A total of 42 officers and men had been killed, and 20 more wounded in 2.5 hours of vicious hand-to-hand fighting. The bodies of hundreds of slain North Vietnamese littered the bloody battleground. Captain Edwards was helped across the landing zone to the battalion aid station by Specialist 4 Ernie Paolone. The medics at the aid station got him on plasma and IV fluids immediately. Minutes later, Specialist Arthur Vieira was carried in on a poncho, bleeding from his many wounds. The most serious was the bullet hole through his throat. Captain Carrara, the battle surgeon, knelt over Vieira under fire and calmly performed a battlefield tracheotomy without anesthesia or even clean hands. Sergeant Jack Yamaguchi, the combat cameraman, leaned forward and captured the impromptu surgery on film. After his film got back to the Pentagon, Yamaguchi and his partner Sergeant Shiro were reprimanded for capturing the stark reality of combat so graphically. Against all odds, Arthur Vieira survived. When Myron Dieterich and Rick Rescorla reached the Charlie Company sector, they were shocked by what they saw. Wrote Dieterich, "When I arrived, only a handful from C-17, Charlie Company 1st Battalion 7th Cavalry, and my platoon, which was attached to them, were left. That company suffered heavy casualties. The enemy got as far as the southern edges of LZ X-ray, but didn't quite make it. Some fighting was in progress, but for all practical purposes, the enemy was beaten." Dillon assembled the battered survivors of Charlie Company near the Termite Hill command post as the new battalion reserve, such as it was, and saw to it that they got ammo, water, and sea rations. Charlie Company had done yeoman's work these 2 days. Sergeant Kennedy, the senior-ranking survivor, organized his weary men into 2 provisional platoons and designated subordinate leaders. Dieterich's men began the grim task of recovering American dead and wounded and policing up enemy documents and weapons. Lieutenant Rick Rescorla will never forget the scene as he moved his men into the battle area. "There were American and NVA bodies everywhere. My area was where Lieutenant Gahagan's platoon had been. There were several dead NVA around his platoon command post. One dead trooper was locked in contact with a dead NVA, hands around the enemy's throat. There were two troopers, one black, one Hispanic, linked tight together. It looked like they had died trying to help each other. A lot of dead North Vietnamese. They had white wall haircuts thick on top. Their weapons were laying all over.
Rescorla traveled the full length of the front when he was ordered to take some men and go help Lieutenant Lane on the far right.
The NVA were laying all over the place. Colonel Moore and Sergeant Major Plumley were out there with us. We policed up all the weapons, packs, and ammo and made two piles, one NVA, one American. It looked like the NVA had dragged off some of their dead and wounded. That night when we got hit and various of our weapons jammed or went out, we used the spare Charlie Company weapons. Also, we put their packs to use as we had left ours back in the rear. Later, we went out 300 yards, more NVA bodies. We had plenty of time to clear fields of fire, dig in, register the artillery, and get ready for the night. Although the enemy had withdrawn, he had left stay-behind snipers, and Diederich's men came under sporadic fire, as did the landing zone and battalion command post. There were marksmen up in the trees and up on the termite hills. The North Vietnamese had been beaten back but hadn't quit yet. Out in the Charlie Company sector, Sergeant Major Plumley and I walked through the horrible debris of battle. We found Lieutenant Jack O'Hagan's body. The two of us personally carried him from the battlefield. Then we returned, located Platoon Sergeant Luther Gilreath's body, and brought him back to the landing zone to begin the long journey home. Off to our east, more help was on the way. Lieutenant Colonel Bob Tully and his 2nd Battalion, 5th Cavalry, were marching in overland. Earlier, Tully had radioed asking for the best route and formation for a move into X-ray. As cryptically as possible over an insecure radio net, I told him, "Come in, paying close attention to the left flank, closest to the mountain." Says Tully, "How did I move?" "One company along the flank of the mountain, one other out beating the bushes. Two up, one back." Initially, my concern was that the enemy would try to block us or slow us down near a north-south hill mass. To preclude this, I sent Bravo Company on the right and shot in several artillery concentrations in that area. Once we got past that line of hills, I knew we could get to X-ray in good order. Tully's battalion encountered no enemy until about 10 a.m. when Captain Larry Bennett's Alpha Company ran into a North Vietnamese strong point. Says Bennett, "We were about 800 yards from X-ray when my two lead platoons were suddenly pinned down by heavy automatic weapons fire. The NVA were in the trees, behind and on top of the anthills. We used fire and movement with my two lead platoons. I swung my 3rd platoon to the right flank on a line and the resistance was broken rapidly. Due to the firefight and maneuvering, we hit the southern half of X-ray. With the landing zone relatively safe, we called for Bruce Crandall's helicopters to come in and collect the wounded. Warrant Officer Pop Jekyll.
I was told to wait for wounded. We sat in the LZ for at least one full enlistment before someone came out to the chopper on all fours and said, 'Get the hell out of here, you're drawing fire.' We did."
Captain Bob Edwards rode out in one of Crandall's heavily overloaded flying ambulances. Matt Dillon recalls that Lieutenant Franklin, terribly wounded in the lower abdomen, had been set aside, triaged as someone unlikely to survive his wounds. His place was taken by someone the medics felt had a better chance of living. Matt Dillon was having none of that. He dragged Franklin back to the Huey and insisted he be taken. Franklin was pulled in, his head hanging out the door. Bob Edwards says, "They threw Lieutenant Franklin in right on top of me." The chopper unloaded at LZ Falcon, and Edwards remembers talking with Major Herman Worth, the battalion executive officer, and Lieutenant Bobby Hadaway from the supply section. Says Worth,
"Bob Edwards had been hit seriously in the left shoulder and had lost a lot of blood. He was pale-faced, white, near death. There was a real question whether he would live. A transfusion was administered, and Bob came fully alert and talkative. Tremendous transformation."
Edwards remembers being placed on a stretcher on the ground, His wounded left arm flopped off the stretcher in the dirt. He shouted loud enough when someone stepped on that arm, and they flopped it back on my stretcher. Although Edward says he never lost consciousness in X-ray or on the evac flight, when he finally reached the Army hospital at Quignon, it was another story.
I had to take a leak bad. They gave me a shiny container to pee in while lying down. I didn't want that, so I stood up to pee. When I came to, I was flat on my back.
Lieutenant Franklin, who rode out of X-ray on top of Edwards, also survived. Over the radio, we got the word that Tully's 2nd Battalion, 5th Cavalry, was 30 minutes away from X-ray. Dillon passed the orders to our eastern and southern perimeters to hold their fire, and about 11:45 a.m., the lead elements of Tully's battalion began arriving. Lieutenant Rescorla was standing near Lieutenant Cahagan's command post foxhole looking southeast.
Most of them were off to my left front, moving toward us in a column formation. The sergeant came up to me and said, "You boys must have put up a hell of a fight." I said, "No, it wasn't us. The credit belongs to them."
I pointed towards some of the American dead, the men of Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry. Tully's Bravo Company marched in directly through the beaten zone downrange from Delta Company, where Sergeant Warren Adams's 9 M60 machine guns had been sawing away for the previous 2 hours. Lieutenant Litton and Sergeant Adams happily watched the reinforcements march in. Says Adams,
"I watched the point man as he came right into my position, and the first words out of the young man's mouth was, 'My God, there's been a heavy battle here. Hell, there's bodies all over this valley down through here. For the last 30 minutes, we've just been walking around and over and through bodies to get here. You guys have been playing combat for real here.'"
Specialist Vincent Cantu watched the reinforcements march in and got his second major shock of the day. Cantu had already run into his old high school classmate Joe Galloway. Now he had a family reunion as well.
"The first guy I saw walk in was my cousin, Joe Fierova, from Woodsboro, Texas. He saw me and said, 'What's going on, Cat?' I replied, 'Joe, get down low and stay there.'
I motioned to all our dead." Specialist 4 Pat Selleck, 24 and a native of Mount Kisco, New York, says,
"I remember one guy had a small American flag on the back of his pack. When I saw that, I felt very proud. It's something that's always stuck with me. This American flag was put on top of a blown-up tree, just like Iwo Jima. Another battle we had won for the United States."
That little flag flew over landing zone X-ray for the rest of the flight, raising all our spirits. We had a lot to do now, and I tried to rank the chores by priority. First and foremost was to maintain the highest state of alert against further enemy attacks. Second was to rescue Ernie Savage and the Lost Platoon. Third, I wanted an early and complete accounting of every man killed or wounded by name. Finally, we needed more ammo, water, and sea rats. Major Worth had sent the assistant S4 Lieutenant Bobby Hadaway to the Charlie Med casualty clearing station at Camp Holloway, where he would keep personal track of arriving casualties and check their names against the company rosters. Lieutenant Hadaway had spent nearly 2 years in Charlie Company. He knew all the men. It now fell to Hadaway to go down the line of leaders and look into the faces of so many friends and comrades and mark them killed in action. It was a heartbreaking job. By 12:05 p.m., Bob Tully's battalion had closed on X-ray. I shook his hand and told him he was mighty welcome. Dillon and I had discussed how we would go about rescuing Savage's men and now had a pretty clear idea. Now we began briefing Tully on his battalion's major role in that plan. In the meantime, we were advised that General Dick Knowles had authorized the movement of 2 more 105mm howitzer batteries, 12 more big guns, into landing zone Columbus, just over 3 miles away. One was from the 2nd Battalion, 17th Artillery, commanded by my West Point classmate, Lieutenant Colonel Harry O. Amos, Jr., a 42-year-old Alabama native. The other was from Lieutenant Colonel Bob Short's 1st Battalion, 21st Artillery. Soon we would have 4 batteries, 24 big guns, firing in direct support of us. Things were beginning to go our way at last. Chapter 14. Rescuing the Lost Platoon. War is fear, cloaked in courage. General William C. Westmoreland. It was now approaching noon on Monday, November 15th, and the time had come to push out again, this time with 3 companies, and rescue the Lost Platoon. Although the men of my battalion wanted to be the ones who did the job of bringing their comrades back into the perimeter, common sense dictated that Lieutenant Colonel Bob Tully's newly arrived 2nd Battalion 5th Cavalry, guided by Captain John Heron's Bravo Company, be given the mission. My Gary Owen troopers desperately needed this lull to reorganize their depleted squads and platoons, evacuate their wounded, resupply with water and ammo, and screen the battlefield in front of them. 2 of Tully's companies were on the south side of the clearing and could easily continue moving around the other ring of defenses toward the trapped men. There was no time to waste pulling my companies off the line, replacing them with Tully's, and then assembling them for the mission. Tully and I were agreed. I would give him Captain John Heron's Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, which knew the ground and the route, and he would leave me his Bravo Company and his Delta Company. Tully would carry out a battalion-size assault, preceded by a heavy fire support, with 2 companies abreast on line and 1 company trailing in reserve. Tully. Palmore's proposal was most logical and practical. My unit was still on the move, still mobile. Time was of the essence. My battalion used a simple 2-up-1-back formation, A-2-5 on the left, B-1-7 on the right, C-2-5 following A-2-5. The reason for a heavy left formation was that the main enemy activity appeared to be from the mountainous area on our left. All that was required was to get Heron's company in the act and move out. Outside of a few coordinating instructions, there was little need to tell Heron much. He knew where the isolated platoon was, and he was anxious to extricate it. Tully's 96-man Alpha Company on the left was commanded by Captain Larry Bennett. We passed through the southern half of X-ray under rather heavy sniper fire from the south, which made the passage rather hairy, to say the least. Behind Bennett was Captain Ed Boyce Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 5th Cavalry. After the prep fires lifted, Tully and his 3 companies kicked off the attack at precisely 1:15 p.m. Heron says, "We had no contact en route. We put in a very good helicopter rocket strike between us and the cutoff platoon. Shortly thereafter, I saw 2 North Vietnamese running to the right through the woods about 300 yards away, getting out of the area. Once we got to the platoon, we got some sniper fire from the Chu Pong Hill mass in the southwest." Lieutenant Dennis Deal and his surviving troopers were on Heron's left flank, and this time Deal was loaded for bear. "I had a lot of grenades and threw one behind every anthill we saw. We grenaded our way up to the 2nd platoon position. All that turned out to be unnecessary. We did not meet any opposition. We used grenades extensively and radioed Savage that we were doing so. We didn't want any live enemy between us and the platoon like the day before. I threw 8 or 10 grenades." Even so, it was not a quick trip out. Bob Tully was an experienced battlefield commander, and he saw no need to make it a race against time. His operations officer was Captain Ronald W. Crooks. Crooks says, "Fire support consisted mostly of marking rounds to confirm the location if we needed artillery quickly. We were not trying to surprise the enemy. He knew where we were, and I am pretty sure he knew what our mission was. We fired additional rounds as harassment and interdiction fires to the south along the mountain to help secure Alpha 2-5's left flank and also forward of their advance. There was nothing there. No snipers, no ambushes, nothing but dead North Vietnamese soldiers and their weapons. I was puzzled but delighted at the radio reports. While Tully was advancing, I passed orders to all companies on the X-ray perimeter to screen forward 300 yards and police up the battlefield. Sergeant Major Plumley and I again went forward to Bob Edwards' Charlie Company positions.
In my after-action report, I described the scene as follows. Dead PAVN, PAVN body fragments, and PAVN weapons and equipment were littered in profusion around the edge and forward of the perimeter. Numerous body fragments were seen. There was massive evidence, blood trails, bandages, etc., of many other PAVN being dragged away from the area. Some of the enemy dead were found stacked behind anthills. We found some of his dead with ropes tied around the ankles and a short running end free. I saw two of our dead with similar ropes around their ankles. Possibly they had been captured alive and were being dragged off when killed. We found some of our dead's wallets and dog tags on dead PAVN. Artillery and TAC air was placed on all wooded areas nearby into which trails disappeared. Numerous enemy weapons were collected along with other armament. Two prisoners were taken and evacuated. Friendly dead and wounded were collected. Some friendly were killed and wounded in the screening. Over on the right flank of the Charlie Company sector, Sergeant John Sedlin had so far survived the carnage. We were ordered to sweep out 200 yards. We had gone maybe 50 yards on line when we could see the enemy right out in front of us. We fired. They returned it. Then we heard somebody on the right flank. They're coming down the mountain. Sergeant Charlie McManus, PFC Larry Stacy, Lamont, and I went west toward a creek bed. Then we saw these people behind us like they were trying to encircle us. The rest of the platoon came through, and about that time Sergeant McManus shoved Stacy and myself out of the way. Then we heard an explosion and looked down, and there was Charlie McManus laying there dead. He had jumped on a grenade to save our lives. The grenade had come from the creek bed. The enemy had evidently tunneled into the side of it. It didn't take Stacy long to put some M79 rounds into the hole and eliminate him. Staff Sergeant Charles V. McManus of Woodland, Alabama, was 31 years old when he gave his own life to save those of his friends. Over on the northern side of the perimeter, Specialist John Wilenius was about to solve the mystery of the Y-shaped tree trunk and the pop-up shooting range target. A sweep was made forward from our positions by a unit who reported that they found 7 dead North Vietnamese behind the tree, all shot in the head. I didn't go look. During this lull, the saddest, most painful, and hardest duty to endure was collecting our dead and loading them aboard the helicopters. There were so many that the brigade ordered in the big choppers, the CH-47 Chinooks. One such helicopter lifted out all 42 of the dead from Charlie Company. They came in together, died together, and now they left together, wrapped in their green rubber ponchos. Specialist 4 Vincent Cantu says, "We were picking up our dead and placing them in the choppers. Some of these guys I had known for 2 years, yet I could recognize them only by their name tags. Their faces were blown off. It was hard not to get sick. We would look at each other and without saying a word, just continue putting our dead on the choppers." Mid-morning, before Tully arrived, Colonel Tim Brown flew in for a visit. Plumley recalls, "Lieutenant Colonel Moore saluted Brown and said, 'I told you not to come in here. It's not safe.' Brown picked up his right collar lapel and waggled his full colonel's eagle at Moore and said, 'Sorry about that.' Dylan and I gave him a situation report. Brown asked whether he should stay in X-ray, establish a small brigade command post, and run the show. We recommended against that. I knew the area, and Bob Tully and I got along just fine. Brown agreed. Lieutenant Dick Merchant said, 'Colonel Brown had trust and confidence in his commanders. I'm aware that some felt he should have landed in X-ray and established a command post. I've never accepted that. The 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry, was probably the finest battalion in Vietnam, well-trained, superbly led, with outstanding officers and NCOs throughout the unit. Brown would have been out of place in X-ray. Besides, there was no room for a brigade CP. I recall it being rather crowded behind that anthill.' Just before he departed, Colonel Brown told us that we had done a great job, but now that Tully's fresh battalion was coming in, along with two rifle companies of the 2nd Battalion, 7th Cav, he would likely pull us out of X-ray the following day. As we walked past the growing heaps of North Vietnamese equipment, Brown turned and asked if I would bring him a North Vietnamese pith helmet when I came out. He got his helmet. As the lull lengthened and Tully continued to report no opposition to his movements, Dylan and I tried to puzzle out what the North Vietnamese were up to. Where were the survivors of those enemy battalions? Where had they taken their wounded? They had to have water for drinking, cooking, and taking care of those wounded. There may have been streams and springs in the ravines on the Chu Pong above us, but to carry wounded up those steep slopes would be a slow, difficult process. The nearest flowing stream on our map was the Ia Drang, 2 miles north. To us, that seemed a more likely field hospital site than the slopes of the mountain. Add to that the fact that shortly after noon on November 15th, the Air Force's high-flying B-52 bombers out of Guam placed the first of 6 days of arc light strikes on the Chu Pong Massif. For the first time ever, the B-52 strategic bombers were being employed in a tactical role in support of American ground troops. The personality of this battle was changing dramatically, and the enemy commander cannot have been a happy man this noon. Lieutenant Colonel Nguyen Huan was standing in one of the communications trenches up on the slopes of the Chu Pong Massif. He remembers seeing and counting, high above him, 18 B-52 bombers before he dove back in his deep bunker. Minutes later, the first of the 500-pound bomb struck no more than 600 yards from his bunker. But the huge explosions walked away from Colonel An, not toward him. He would live to fight on, but always with an appreciation of just how close a call he had on Chu Pong this day. Up on the Lost Platoon's little knoll, Sergeant Ernie Savage had passed the news that help was on the way. That raised the men's spirits, but it did not lessen their vulnerability. Savage says, "We got some firing right after daylight. We stayed down. Anytime they saw us, they'd fire on us. It's not clear what the North Vietnamese had in mind for the surrounded Americans. Wait them out? Starve them out? Pick them off one by one with sniper fire?" Whatever they had planned, just before 3 p.m., Herons and Bennett's companies reached the shallow ditch and immediately came under enemy rifle fire. It was rapidly suppressed by long bursts of machine gun fire. Savage was following the rescuers' progress. There was some fighting just before the relief got to us. They ran into something, not much. I could hear talk on the radio about killing some snipers. The rescuers crossed the ditch, just as Lieutenant Henry Toro Herrick's men had the day before. From the ditch westward, visibility was good as the ground rose to the small knoll on the far northwest side of the clearing. For the rescue to be carried out, the clearing had to be secured. Says Bob Tully, "We secured the platoon by simply surrounding them after we reached their position." Captain Bennett says, "On arrival at the clearing, I was told to secure the eastern half of it. It was egg-shaped, maybe 250 yards by 75 yards, with high grass and tree stumps throughout." John Heron recalls, "We picked our way through blown-down trees, anthills, and scrub brush until we reached the platoon." By then, some of Bennett's troopers had seen the small band of surviving Americans and hollered to them. Sergeant Zollin, up on the knoll with Savage, knew that the long ordeal was coming to a close, but his heart was heavy. "I couldn't bear to look at Sergeant Palmer." Now the lead elements of John Heron's company approached the clearing, with Heron well forward and anxious to be reunited with what was left of his missing 2nd platoon. Heron says, "It was a scene I will never forget. First we found the remains of Sergeant Hurdle and his weapon squad, who had been overrun. There were dead North Vietnamese sprawled nearby. Next, the small groups of Savage's and McHenry's men, some heavily bandaged, all of them covered with dirt and tired, but excited at seeing us." Sergeant William Rowland of Bravo Company's 1st Platoon says the distance between where Hurdle and his machine gunners fought and died and the rest of Herrick's platoon, 60 to 70 yards, made it plain that the brave machine gun crews had given their lives buying time so their buddies could withdraw to higher ground. In that tiny perimeter, every man who could fire a weapon still had ammunition left, even after 26 hours of combat. There were 29 men in the 2nd Platoon, Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry when the fight started. 29 men were brought out. 9 dead, 13 wounded, and 7 unscratched. All the casualties had been suffered in the first 90 minutes of combat.